Taking a child, he placed it in their midst, and his arms around them. Whoever receives one child such as this in my name receives me, and the one who sent me. I'm always fascinated. I think about it. It's a curious thing for me. Just what is it about the child particularly that Christ is referring to? I mean, children are a great gift. They provide so much joy, and they are an exciting and wonderful thing. They also can be little monsters that run around and scream and make a mess everywhere. I mean, so really, you know, there's a lot to consider there. What is it particularly that Christ is referring to? Is it their ability to scream and embarrass parents? I mean, that would be a fascinating thing, but I'm not sure that's what Jesus is referring to. He says whoever receives his child. There's something about the innocence, the child, that is something truly remarkable. It is a fascinating thing. It's sometimes a little harder to define. Innocence is a little hard to define outside of a court of law. When we try and refer to childlike innocence, there's something more to it. It's not something for a simple definition. There's something more to it. It is a curiosity in so many ways. What I find especially interesting, as a seminarian, I've had many opportunities in my life to encounter a lot of classrooms, encounter a lot of different age groups within those classrooms, and especially in my college year, I actually went with two other guys. We went around to an entire school, and we covered all the classrooms. We'd given a topic, and we'd kind of cover the school each and every week. And I had kindergarten, and I had third grade, and I had junior high, and then I'd go back to fifth grade. We spent the longest time in fifth grade. That was the confirmation prep year. So it was interesting to me just to present a topic to these different age groups and to see exactly what they absorbed, how they interacted with the information given, and how they came to see these things. What I truly remarked was incredible, really, is how each one sort of saw things. What fascinated me the most was whenever you expressed the passing of someone. If we talked about someone who had died, someone who passed away, and how each grade sort of absorbed that. You know, in kindergarten, they would hear that information, and then they would tell you, they would list for you every person that they ever knew the name of that had died, including pets and family pets and pets of family's pets. So, you know, they just had this sort of litany of all these people died. You know, they could keep track of that for me, but it didn't really connect beyond that. It was just a sort of a fun factoid for them. They were looking for how it connected to them. In third grade, they began to sort of empathize. They knew the sorrow that people could experience from these things, and so they didn't want necessarily anyone else to experience that sorrow either. You get up to junior high, and well, they don't want to feel anything, or at least they don't want to tell you they feel things, and they don't want to ask questions either. So the less that they engage you, the more they feel that they're securing their position and social status. So they try and maintain that as best they can. They don't want to really engage in it, but they know it's something more. What's really remarkable is coming back to fifth grade, that was sort of a connection of all of these things. You know, fifth graders were probably a little further down trying to embrace junior high, who wanted to distance themselves from it, whereas others would want to try and share it as something connected to them. What kind of brought it all together was, fascinating enough, was this desire to see where it fit into their lives. How does it connect to them? How does it relate to them? How is it in their life? And what's fascinating is, as we watch this develop, is as much as very young children actually kind of sort of express themselves kind of selfishly. I mean, if you ever meet a baby, they're very selfish. Just tell them, and they'll just yell at you anyway. But even if it seems very selfish in the beginning, there's actually a desire to grow into selfishness as we get further down the line. Our ability to sort of separate our own selfishness, to actually sort of see a perspective outside of ourselves, is actually one of these great gifts of innocence. It is this willingness to connect with somebody else that really allows us to see what it is that Christ is offering us. It requires, though, that we kind of step outside of ourselves and be willing to become something less. And it's even more fascinating to me where this conversation comes up, because what happens just before this? What prompts Christ to say this? But they're having an argument about who's the greatest. They're having this argument about who's the best among the apostles. I don't even know what criteria they're using, but they're trying to assert themselves as the best follower of Jesus. And what does he do? He says, you must become a servant of all. You must embrace this child. It's such a a curious analogy, such a curious way to express leadership. I think of St. Gregory the Great, probably because I went to St. Gregory the Great Seminary and I heard about him all the time. But his feast day is here in September, so I think of him especially during this month, partially because we would begin the school year and then we'd celebrate the feast of St. Gregory the Great, and Bishop Ruskowitz would come out and then he would announce that he was going to give us the day off. And I actually one time asked him if he founded a school just so that he could give people days off willy-nilly, and he laughed, but he never actually answered the question, so good luck with that. But St. Gregory the Great really took this to heart. He took this passage very particularly to heart. He took a title for himself as Bishop of Rome that every Pope since him has actually taken the same title. He said, "I have become the servant of the servants of God." Because he took this very much to heart. And if we are to lead, then we must be willing to surrender our own position and actually place the needs of someone else in front of our own. We must displace ourselves for that. And it's fascinating to me because St. Gregory the Great took his position as Bishop of Rome at such a difficult time in the city of Rome. They were in economic disaster. The whole thing was kind of plunging in on itself. The whole thing was coming apart. There was extreme poverty and no jobs, and the whole thing was just rampant. It was awful. And he had already been a prelate in the city. He had been a lawyer in the city, and he was extremely well-liked, which possibly is a miracle in and of itself right there. But they made him rise not only as, well, they made him a deacon, and then they made him a bishop really quick because they really liked what he was doing. But within a very small amount of time, he was made both pope and head of the city of Rome. They called him mayor, but mayor's kind of misleading. He had dictatorial power. I mean, he had the same powers as a dictator, but they called him mayor. Good luck with that title. And he took this job at a time when it was not well received. What I mean by that is Rome was very much concerned about fixing the city, but they wanted to receive results immediately. So they would appoint a mayor, and if he didn't make it all better in 7 days, they killed him, which is not a lot of time to try and fix large-scale economic poverty and crisis, but they didn't have a lot of patience for it either. But then they made the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, also the mayor, and they weren't sure if they were ready to execute a mayor in 7 days, so they were a little more hesitant and a little more willing to let him try. It all became very fascinating. St. Gregory the Great wrote some incredible things on how we strive for this path of holiness. How do we live for this mark of holiness? It really is fascinating. He wrote one particularly moving piece on holiness. He said, if you really want to be holy, if you want to live the life of holiness, if you really want to be the great model of holiness, then be a monk and never interact with anyone ever. And that's way easier to be holy if you never talk to people. But if you have to talk to people, then you have to take the harder route. And there is that greater challenge for you, but there's that greater reward as well. It's that greater gift of striving for holiness by engaging the people around us. What we had to do at the very heart of it was embrace humility. And this is this fascinating thing. Gregory the Great embraced humility in this radical way. He said, I have become the servant of the servants of God. He wanted to show his leadership by being willing to place everyone else's needs in front of his own, not to the point where he killed himself. I mean, he recognized he had to address his needs as they came up, but to never underestimate that it was constantly for those others' goods, the goods of his bishops, the goods of the people of Rome. All of these great things were always placed in front of his own. He always placed their needs and their greatest needs in front of anything else. He didn't care to be popular. He didn't care to do it the popular way. He didn't even want to be entertaining about it. He just wanted to do it for the best of the people. And many of the reforms that he instituted were incredibly unpopular, but they did save the city. Many of the things that he did were new or nuanced and really didn't seem to have a lot of momentum to them, but they worked. And it became this radical embrace where he wanted humility first, where he said, I must become the servant of the servants. I must embrace this great humility. And it sounds great. It sounds really nice. And we can build everyone else up if we can put someone else's needs in front of our own. It sounds really encouraging if we can do that. And it sounds like a kind of thing we can really get behind, or at least I think it's an exciting thing that we can really get behind. Unfortunately, most of the time when we think, gosh, that would be a really great thing, we're always thinking of someone else who should do it instead of ourselves. We always think, yeah, you know, if those people start thinking of my needs first, you know, this could be a whole lot easier. You know, we could get this really moving a lot faster. But we all have to embrace it. We all have to embrace this this willingness to put someone else first, to put the needs, the goods of those around us in front of our own, and that selflessness. And it's difficult. It's incredibly difficult. Because we have examples, reminders, just like in the Book of Wisdom here, that remind us of what it is when we start to do that. When we're willing to step outside of ourselves and place the good of someone else in front of us, when we're willing to become that humble person and embrace that humility, we encounter a situation much like wisdom, where we are reminded that there are wicked people out there who say, let us harass, let us annoy, let us beset this one who wants to be humble, this one who wants to live in justice. Why? Because they're causing problems? No. Because they're hard on life? No. Because they're making it harder for me? Not really. Because they're obnoxious. Because they're annoying. Because their way of life bothers the way I live my life. It doesn't actually interrupt it. It doesn't actually stop it. But it bothers me because they're trying to live a just life. And it is obnoxious to me. And so we beset him. It's hard to be encouraging about being humble when we know that we're going to go out there and struggle, and we know we're going to go out there and face these difficulties, and yet that is exactly what we are encouraged to do. I think about this, the besetting the just one. I think about it when I was growing up. One of my neighbors was very close to my younger brother's age. I was outside talking to him at his house, and he said, you know, your little brother, he cries over just the littlest of things. I said, well, how do you mean? He said, well, here, he's coming over, I'll show you. And he went over to my brother, who just walked by, and he started to say the most awful things to him, calling him names and belittling him and just saying awful things to him. And sure enough, my brother broke down and cried and ran off. And he came back to me and said, see, he just cries over the littlest of things. I said, I have a new theory. We're going to play a new game. He said, oh, yeah? I said, yeah, I have this theory. I think your nose is going to bleed over the smallest of punches to your face. He said, I don't think I want to play this game. I said, no. I don't think I want the way you treat my brother. Sure enough, he didn't talk to my brother for 6 months, so at least I had that going for me. But it was this great reminder that we see this besetting of the just one. Because of what? Because he's obnoxious? Because this humility bothers us? Because when we witness this humility, it's upsetting to us. And we don't necessarily get to see the great rewards of it. It's not always rewarding to try and live in this life of humility. Honestly, I saw my brother later that day. Well, we share a room. It was kind of inevitable I was going to see him later that day. He was mad at me. More than mad at me, he was hurt. He said all those awful things to me, and you just stood there. You didn't do anything. And I said, you're right, I didn't. And I'm sorry. And that's oftentimes what that reward of humility is going to get us. It's going to get more people to yell at us. Not that we want to look forward to it. Not that we get excited about it. But rather, we should be ever mindful, ever remembering that we do this by being willing to live in service of others. That if we embrace this service, if we embrace being the servant of others, that it will not always be well received, and that humility often will come with its own difficulty. But that doesn't mean that we should become disheartened by it. But rather, embracing that child, remember that he who receives him receives God himself. I have a challenge for you this week. I want you to try and live into humility, not just because it's something we do. And you can even think about it. You might be even more humble in your life than you realize. Maybe you're more, maybe you're less. I'm not going to tell you that part, but I really want to challenge you to see the needs of others in front of your own and place them at your interest. To make the other person's good in front of your own, at the very heart of what you're trying to do. I know parents do this all the time. It's just a habit for some of them. They don't even necessarily have to think about it, but I want you to consider that humility and see it as a gift from God, as that opportunity to grow in grace, as that opportunity to live for God by being willing to step down ourselves and place someone else's needs in front of our own.